Greetings, Sun Sounds listeners, and welcome to the Philosopher Program. This is your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. We begin our program with some daily selections from Science of Mind, Guide for Spiritual Living. And the theme again for this month is Nothing to be Healed. You control your conditions. Consciousness is the creative cause of conditions. Neville Goddard. We believe in the control of conditions through the power of this mind. Ernest Holmes, What We Believe. Having the power to control conditions is where many people draw the line in studying the philosophy of Ernest Holmes. But this is not a fringe concept. Writings by Stoics, mystics, philosophers, psychologists, and every school of metaphysics for two millennia demonstrate that we have this ability. The circumstances of our lives are not arbitrary. They come to us because there's something in our consciousness that creative mind uses to attract those circumstances. So we already and always control the conditions of our lives. It is when we take conscious charge of what we think, say, believe, and feel that conditions improve. This is why it is so important to not seek a cause for any condition outside of ourselves, even when we feel justified in blaming someone or something else for doing this to us. They could not change our condition without something within us allowing it to happen. Blaming yourself does not help either. Just know that if it came from your consciousness, you have the absolute authority to redirect creative mind toward manifesting something different, something better. Affirmation. My life is brilliantly wonderful every day. We direct our own lives. All shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. Julian of Norwich. We believe in the eternal goodness, the eternal loving kindness, and the eternal givingness of life to all. Ernest Holmes, What We Believe. Goodness was one of the hardest concepts for me to embrace in my early days as a student of Science of Mind. For many years, I preferred the mystical concept that there is no good or bad, only what is. This implies that labels are determined by the observer. Yet it was impossible not to notice how often in his writings, Holmes uses the word good. As a result, I've come to believe that Holmes is not making a moral claim, but rather identifying the nature of divine source. He expressed his understanding of source not as indifferent or hostile, but as exceedingly harmonious, life-giving, expansive, and fulfilling. In much the same way Julian of Norwich, some 650 years earlier, through her direct mystical experience, described divine reality as unchanging goodness. Even in medieval Europe, she experienced the divine not as punitive, resistant, or indifferent, but as benevolent and life-affirming. Holmes also saw eternal presence as compassionate, demonstrating through its eternal loving kindness and givingness without influencing our choices or direction. To me, the good of God, of spirit, of the universe, is that we can direct our lives through a creative mind that transforms what we express into what we experience. That is very, very good. Affirmation. It is my divine nature to be eternally good, kind, generous, and life-affirming. And from the Daily Word published by Unity, World Peace. The peace of my soul brings peace to the world. The Bible's sacred pairings, lions and lambs, swords and plowshares, reveal that peace becomes possible when I and others hold life's polarities in harmony. These verses remind me that wholeness arises not from opposition, but from integration. Within all people, strength and tenderness, boundaries and compassion, courage and vulnerability arise from the same divine source. Lion and lamb are not rivals. They are facets of one creation. Sword and plow are not contradictions. They're different tools for transformation. Peace begins when we see that opposites, both within and around us, can be allies rather than adversaries. As this realization takes root, any impulse to defend or harden begins to fade. Protection. The stability of God's protection steadies me in an unsteady world. When I look out at the world, I may perceive genuine dangers. I may even tell myself life's scary and painful events of life are inevitable. Yet I know in my heart, regardless of conditions, I am always protected at the level of spirit. The psalmist said God would walk with me in the valleys of shadow, not that deep places do not exist. Today I take refuge knowing my footing is secure and my future is as bright as the promises of God, of Spirit, of the universe. I accept the joys and challenges of daily living. I trust my feet will find a safe path through any difficulties. I live my faith in God, in Spirit, in the universe, secure in the belief I will never walk alone. And from The Bright Side, quotes to inspire and empower by the editors of Guideposts, optimism helps us persevere. John Jacobs, co-founder of the Life is Good clothing company. At the end of your time here, the world will either be more or less kind, compassionate, generous, funny, creative, and loving because of your presence in it, and you alone get to choose. John Pavlovitz, pastor and author. The power of prayer is not in the one who hears it and not in the one who says it. Our prayers do make a difference. Max Lucado, writer and pastor. Work hard. Don't quit. Be appreciative. Be thankful. Be grateful. Be respectful. Also, never whine. Never complain. Michael Keaton, actor. A grateful heart is a magnet for miracles. Roma Downey, actor. Someday is nowhere to live your life. Rachel Macy Stafford, author. Being happy is really the definition of success, isn't it? Jim Gaffigan, comedian. We savor these moments out of time when we are conscious of love's presence, these holy moments of gratitude, and that is grace. Anne Lamott, writer. We return to Science of Mind for the column by Mark Waldman and Andrew Newberg, Science and Spirituality, The Power of Self-Nurturance. Are negative thoughts and feelings stifling your motivation? Is procrastination stopping you from making decisions and taking action? Do you worry about your future? All of these mental states reflect different forms of anxiety and can derail your brain from optimal performance. But you can eliminate that neurological stress by mindfully yawning 5 or 6 times. Put yourself into a deeply relaxed and spiritual state, and you'll boost your self-esteem. And here's another stress-reducing strategy rarely discussed: self-nurturance through pleasant touch. Self-nurturance is a proactive daily commitment distinct from reactive self-care that involves self-compassion, setting boundaries, and creating a supportive environment to feel refreshed and balanced. It decreases negative feelings and thoughts, and if you regularly engage in giving yourself a reassuring hug, you'll also feel more kindness and compassion. But the touching must be slow and gentle in order to soothe the emotional and social centers of your brain. By stimulating the somatosensory pleasure circuits of the brain, researchers at the University of Leeds in West Yorkshire, England, believe self-touch and massage can effectively treat a wide range of psychological disturbances that will enhance your overall sense of well-being. Your body image can be improved by adding pleasant touch to your spiritual practice, and it can even help you lose weight as you develop new eating habits. Why? Because your brain will turn to comfort food to reduce whatever stresses you out. But what if you substituted physical comfort when you felt hungry or immediately after you felt full? You'd eat less and enjoy it more. Add some meditation to your meals, and you'll actually gain more control over making healthy eating choices. Try this experiment now. Close your eyes and think about something that makes you anxious or worried. Now begin to gently and slowly explore your fingers, hands, and arms in the most pleasurable ways possible. Now slow it down, really slow, taking 60 seconds to explore your palms, your scalp, or your face. Notice how your anxiety virtually disappears, and the slower you go, the more you'll be able to enter that exquisite spiritual state of being in the present moment, free of worries, fears, and doubts. The neuroscience is simple. You cannot simultaneously focus on a pleasurable and painful stimulus, like anxiety. Feeling tired or pressured at work? Do a minute of self-nurturance, and your focus and productivity will increase. And if you're having problems with your sleep, spend a few minutes giving yourself a gentle massage. Again, the pleasure turns off the busy thoughts in your frontal lobes that often keep us awake. Yawn, stretch, and hug yourself. What a great way to increase your happiness and success. And from the same issue, a short piece by Marilyn Leo. Wishing doesn't make it so, or does it? Starlight, star bright, first star I see tonight. I wish I may, I wish I might, have this wish I wish tonight. Do you remember being young, looking up at the sky and making a wish? At about 6 or 7 years old, I was one of those children. What was my deepest desire that was impossible to fulfill? I wished for an older brother. For some reason, I had a picture in my mind of a brother who looked after me, who I looked up to and depended on. Where I got such a Hallmark-style vision is beyond me. I only knew Dick, Jane, and Spot. There was no television to bring me fantasies. Where did I get such ideas of how life would be so wonderfully different if I had an older brother? Being the firstborn, I was the older sister and first cousin in a family of many. Therefore, I could only have an older brother in my imagination. But no, the impossible can become possible. How? Soon after I turned 8, my mother married a widowed man with a 12-year-old son. My wish came true. Now, you would think that each night after that I'd be out looking for that first star and making wishes. But after that miracle of getting an older brother, I didn't seem to have the interest. Was I putting the law into motion with that wish? Or was it just a childish notion that if you wish hard enough, it can happen? In addition to having a son, another plus in my mother's marriage to Reginald Armour was that he was a Science of Mind minister. From the age of 8, I lived in an atmosphere of can do, can be. Why not? Years later, I learned a desire can become an intention. That intention begins an action, the law in motion, that will bring forth a fulfillment of the desire, a healing, a job, a friend, guidance. When we listen, we will hear, feel, sense, see our next move. Do you have a specific desire? Then move toward it. Keep your mind's eye on the goal. The path will open and show you the way. We don't need to figure out every move. Just be still, and your guidance will be available. This may sound easy and childlike, but Jesus told us to be as a child. In other words, have the faith of a child. Believe in your highest good. Have faith. Know deep within yourself that the indwelling God, good, is the same good in everyone. I hear people say they have grown spiritually. They may feel this is so, but it is impossible. We are already pure spirit. We didn't become more spiritual, for we're already 100% spiritual. What improves or grows is our own awareness of who we are, our magnificence. Let's get this straight. God, spirit, the universe is spirit. All is God. All is spirit. Each of us is spirit in human form. God showed itself in the form of Jesus, and we tend to think he's the only one who is all spirit. But no, each of us has the same attributes and capabilities as Jesus, as God incarnate. Jesus knew this about himself and tried to teach others that they too are the same. Jesus understood the capacity of love. Love is the healer. He taught us to love all others and all things as we love ourselves. Loving yourself is loving God. You cannot love God and hate yourself or others. It is an impossibility. Love life and all that it brings forth, no matter the appearances or judgments. There is one spirit, and from that one, all is created. Each snowflake is unique. Each grain of sand, flower, leaf, no two identical. So too, we humans are each unique, and yet we are from the one creator. See what can happen when you look into the night sky. When you look at the stars, feel your connection with those stars. You are made of the same stuff. You were created by the same eternal source. Feel your oneness with those vast and far-reaching stars. Speak words of healing for yourself or another. Know that instantaneous healing can take place. Feel the peace as embodied by you, and may God bless you. Reverend Dr. Marilyn Louise Leo grew up knowing Ernest and Hazel Holmes. Many stories of her youth and family are found in her book, In His Company, available by emailing her at, all one word, drmarilynleo@gmail.com. We turn now to the July-August 2026 Spirituality and Health, a publication of Unity, and an interview with Jewel. Enlightened Perspectives, Jewel on the Healing Power of Truth. Grammy-nominated singer-songwriter Jewel Kilcher, known professionally by only her first name, left Alaska's wide-open quiet for the intensity of the lower 48 at the age of 15. A few years later, she ended up in San Diego to pursue her dreams of a music career, but the road was anything but dreamlike. She lived out of her car, performing at coffee shops and writing songs while navigating poverty, illness, and rejection from record labels. She often credits that chapter in her life for shaping her resilience and songwriting voice, informing the raw honesty that helped launch her breakthrough album, Pieces of You. It also prepared her to cope with more emotional turmoil later, including learning her mother had, by Jewel's account, embezzled $100 million of her earnings. In recent years, Jewel has also earned recognition for her thoughtful work around spirituality and mental health. In this candid conversation with Jerry Strauss, she reflects on art as a practice of integration, the emotional inheritance she worked to rewrite as a teenager, and the life-changing decision to tell the truth in her writing, first in private, then on stage. From surviving homelessness to discovering that vulnerability creates real connection, she shares how awareness, curiosity, and nourishing choices have shaped her understanding of healing and happiness. Jerry Strauss, you're becoming as well known for your passion for spirituality and mental health as you already are for your prolific music. What's the connection? Jewel, a lot of my life has been learning how to get all of me going in the same direction. So often my body is feeling one thing, my mind is doing another thing, my emotions are doing a third thing, and my spirit, who knows? One of the reasons I've always liked writing is because it starts to force all four parts of me to move in the same direction at the same time. And that's a relief because it helps me feel less anxious. I guess you could use the word integration. But I think it's about having practices that help you get all four of those things in alignment, mind, body, emotion, and spirit. My art does that for me. Beyond writing, you've spread your wings and expanded to different types of visual arts over the years. Have those fulfilled the same purpose for you? Yeah, I think any art for me really does it because I'm creating. It forces all four of those things to get on board, which ends up being really rewarding. My art is a really deep reflection of my internal landscape. How do you think growing up in Alaska helped shape your mindset towards spirituality and mental health? It's interesting. A lot of the best writers, people like Neil Young and Joni Mitchell and Leonard Cohen, come from wide-open, desolate places. A lot of them come from the North and Canada. I think it's because open space, quiet time for reflection, and not having distractions causes you to find unique ways of expressing yourself. Alaska really provided that for me, and I think it was critical. I couldn't imagine my life another way. Was it difficult to move away from that life and be on your own in your teens while continuing to be in touch with that side of yourself? Yeah, it was a very hard adjustment coming down to the States. I grew up somewhat feral, and I wasn't prepared on any level. It was a wild transition. The overwhelm, the busyness, the pop culture, the trying to impress everybody all the time, the influence of television. I mean, I came with none of that, so it was an incredibly rude culture shock for sure. When did you first start to learn about mental health and face your own personal challenges? I got very strategic about it when I was 15. That's when I wanted to move out, but I knew that was a really dangerous thing to do. In the movies, when you go from an abusive household to living on your own, it doesn't usually work out better for you. I wouldn't let myself do it until I felt like I had something concrete I could cling to that would help me not become a statistic, so it caused a lot of deep reflection. I was reading a lot of philosophy at the time, so I'd already had this muscle of reflection and an inner dialectic, asking myself questions and finding answers within myself. And what did you come up with? I realized that much like someone can have a genetic inheritance that causes them to be predisposed to diabetes and heart disease, I had an emotional inheritance that was passed on generationally around how to deal with anger, how to deal with conflict. I was probably going to end up being a drug addict or somebody who was in a relationship with a drug addict or end up being abusive or getting into an abusive relationship. That was just the writing on the wall for me. It was my inheritance. I realized I already spoke this language emotionally. My brain had been trained in it. And so if I was going to learn a new emotional language, maybe that would give me a different outcome. That became my very clear conscious goal, to learn a new emotional language. But there was nowhere to go to learn that. That makes sense, because people weren't having those conversations about mental or emotional health then, not until much more recently. It was so interesting. You could go learn Spanish at a community college, yet I'd never heard anybody talk about learning an emotional language. But I found the idea really intriguing and exciting. And so I went ahead and let myself move out with this idea of exploring whether happiness was a learnable skill. Was an emotional language learnable? And so I'd say from that age, my mission officially began. Your life growing up certainly wasn't easy, but do you think having that proactive attitude about your own inner workings helped you avoid even deeper pitfalls? Oh, for sure. I mean, I should have been murdered many, many times. I should have been abducted. I should have been a drug addict. It shouldn't have worked out well for me. So exploring those ideas was 1,000% a good idea. Throughout your career, you've spoken openly about your commitment to authenticity. Did that come naturally from an early age, and did that change with the pressures of fame? When your needs aren't met as a child, your first strategy is to try to be something else to get those needs met. If what you are inherently doesn't seem to be getting the attention of your parents, maybe you should try being something else. And that really is how the journey of inauthenticity begins for most people. When we don't get that love, we're lovesick, and we change ourselves to try to get that love because love is essential. It's critical. I definitely went down the rabbit hole of trying to mask or be other things to different people. Jerry, many of us experience that hesitance to live authentically at some point in our lives, but not all of us are self-aware enough to find our way back to being ourselves. What made you break that pattern and learn to show the world who you really were? I realized at one point that I was in danger of losing track of who I actually was, and it really scared me. That's when I promised myself I would just be honest in writing, no matter what that meant. I would tell myself the truth, even if I didn't tell anybody else, and I put it in my journal so that at least it was like a breadcrumb, a trail back to myself. That ended up being a life-changing habit. When I told the truth in my writing privately to myself, it felt better. So that's already a good biofeedback mechanism. Jerry, obviously there's a huge difference between maintaining authenticity in private writings and putting yourself out there to the world. When did that switch go off for you? I realized when I was homeless that I was so lonely. And honestly, it's not because I didn't know people. It's because I didn't tell anybody who I was. Nobody knew me. And when you're not seen and nobody can connect to your authentic self, it doesn't matter how many friends you have, you're going to be lonely. And so I started singing in the coffee shops at this point. I wasn't signed yet. I was still living in my car. I realized my loneliness was a self-inflicted problem because I wasn't letting anyone in. This thing that helped me survive, which was great, was now harming me, and I had to figure out a way to let this go. I made a conscious decision to say my most private, truthful thoughts in front of these people I'm singing for, and at least I'm going to be known. The good, the bad, and the ugly, for who I actually am. That sounds like a terrifying proposition, especially for someone who was so emotionally closed off from those around her. It was life-changing, because people didn't shun me or ridicule me. They would end up crying during the show and be like, "Oh my God, I didn't know anybody else felt that way." And then I was like, "I didn't know anybody else felt that way." It fostered deep connections, and I realized that through vulnerability, there is safety. When I got discovered at 19, I knew that authenticity still had to be my strategy because I was so young. My way to safety was beating people to the punch, telling people who I was. That way, I'd never get knocked off a pedestal because my fans already knew everything about me. Because of the internet, I was able to foster a pretty honest relationship with people. Jerry, in many people's eyes, mental health means staying in control of your thought process, while spirituality means giving up control. How do you balance the two? I find things change only when we are in relationship to them. So I don't consider having control of my thoughts so much as learning to be aware of my thoughts. I don't try to disassociate myself from them or control them in any way, but I do try to work with them. That takes a level of acceptance and curiosity so that if any of those thoughts are unhealthy, they can be transformed. This is the same strategy I use spiritually. I believe they're all integrated. You have been very open about your battles with anxiety. Certain aspects of life in our current world feel like they can be more triggering every day. How do you avoid those hot-button issues while responsibly being involved in those conversations? What works for each person is a really personal recipe. For instance, I have no television in my home. I don't play the news incessantly because I find it doesn't help me, and it doesn't necessarily educate me either. I find other ways to educate myself about what's going on in the world. You've also helped to educate others about mental health through your Inspiring Children Foundation and Not Alone Challenge. What motivates you to spend so much of your time and energy putting beneficial knowledge and energy out into the world? I find a lot of personal satisfaction in participating and helping in the world, so I do that through my foundation. I learned when I was homeless that no matter how little you have, you can always help, and that helping others is one of the best ways to feel better. Even if you just do it out of selfish reasons, it makes you feel so much less alone and so much more connected. It's one of the best medicines we have for loneliness or depression. There's lots of people who need help, and so the more privilege I have, the more capable I am of helping. Jerry, life is full of peaks and valleys. What was the biggest valley you experienced, and what did you learn from it? I always like to say, never waste a good tragedy. So I try to get the most out of any tragedy I've had, and I've had quite a few. They are there to teach you. I've always had this feeling that if I learn everything I can from them, maybe I'll do better at not repeating them. Being homeless was definitely the best worst time of my life. After I separated from my mom, that was another best worst time that became the biggest moment for transformation. Your journey has given you plenty of happy professional and personal moments. How has the definition of happiness changed for you over the years? The thing about happiness is you can't just get happy. It's not like you can just decide to become happy the same way that you decide to move to France. Happiness is a side effect. For me, it was about learning to make more nourishing choices, healthier and healthier choices, so that happiness could be a side effect of those choices, the same way misery was a side effect of a lot of my poor choices. Jewel Kilcher is a Grammy-nominated singer-songwriter whose debut album, Pieces of You, was released in 1995. She became known for emotionally raw hits like Who Will Save Your Soul, You Were Meant for Me, and Foolish Games, which blend folk, pop, and country influences. Her album, Lullaby, was written for children and their parents. Beyond music, Jewel is an advocate for mental health and youth empowerment. She founded the Inspiring Children Foundation to support at-risk kids. She is also the author of 5 books, including the poetry collection A Night Without Armor, which became a New York Times bestseller, Chasing Down the Dawn, and her 2015 memoir, Never Broken, Songs Are Only Half the Story. Visit jeweljk.com. We pause for a moment to remind you that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of programming from over 300 publications, and you're currently listening to the Philosopher Program with your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis, and I have my co-host, Bullet Lewis, with me also. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info and audio/on demand. We continue now with The Amazing Afterlife of Animals, Messages and Signs from Our Pets on the Other Side by Karen A. Anderson. And we start with a challenging chapter, Chapter 22, Euthanasia, The Impossible Decision. The day you took your last breath was the day my world went dark. Linda Cheladin Fell. When your pet's final days arrive, the daunting decision of euthanasia looms overhead like a dark cloud. Anyone who has been faced with this impossible decision knows firsthand how difficult and confusing this time can be. The final days are torturous, like an emotional roller coaster ride. There are good days when things seem to be improving. Then there are bad days when you question your selfishness for keeping your pet alive. Sometimes animals will miraculously recover and start acting like themselves again. And just when you think they've turned the corner into healing, the inevitable happens, and they go into a downward spiral. This usually happens late at night, on a weekend or on a holiday, the most inopportune time. There is no good time for your pet's days to run out. It brings us to the decision none of us ever want to make, the impossible decision to end our beloved pet's life. Is it right to end their life? We know the day will eventually come when we have to say goodbye. Many of us secretly hope that our pet will pass away peacefully in their sleep, and we won't have to go through with this unimaginable deed. We spend our lives taking care of them, and the last thing we want to do is end their life. Some say that it's not right to take a life. Others feel that it is cruel to allow them to suffer when we can humanely end their pain. Regardless of our opinions, the love we feel for our pets is universal and remains our common bond. The power of love we feel for our pets unites us. Many clients report that they had no idea their pet was ill. They say they were fine one moment and in a health crisis the next. While that may be your initial thought, once you start looking back at their behavior, there are often telltale signs that we dismissed or overlooked. Dismissing strange behavior. It happens to many of us, and I am no exception. I've brushed off strange behaviors or issues with my pets, thinking it was nothing serious. Then when that pet died, I carried that burden of guilt. You might think that I have it easy because I can communicate with my pets, but that's not always the case. While I can ask how they are doing and determine their level of pain, I still have to utilize common sense and learn from past experiences. Over the years, I've learned to pay attention to the details and subtle clues, and I do my best to stay in front of the curve with any known health issues. It's still not foolproof, and things still get by me, but I no longer disregard odd behaviors. Is euthanasia less stressful? Some people believe they should let their pet die on their own. That is the way it would happen in the wild if we weren't in the picture. While that may be true, pets who pass on their own will often tell me that it was a struggle, there was a significant level of suffering, or they were in pain before they died. Because of that, I am an advocate for euthanizing whenever possible. The animals tell me there is far less emotional and physical trauma when they are euthanized. By staying calm, you can help your pet move through their final moments more peacefully. Ultimately, deciding whether or not to euthanize your pet is a personal choice, and you should do what feels right in your heart. No matter what you decide, there's a lot of guilt associated with the end of your pet's life. When is the right time to euthanize? Some of us feel guilty about choosing to euthanize our pet instead of paying for an expensive procedure. We struggle with a decision about when to euthanize and wonder if our pet will be upset with us or if they will ever forgive us for taking their life. We worry that they're suffering or in pain. We may ask ourselves the same questions over and over. Was it the right time? Did I wait too long? Or did I end their life too soon? I'll talk about that actual moment of death in a later chapter, but now let's explore how to know when it is the right time to say goodbye. A personal decision only you can make. Finding the right time to euthanize your pet is a personal decision between you, your veterinarian, and your pet. I will not tell you when to euthanize, but I can help you determine how your pet feels, their pain or discomfort levels, and if they're ready to leave their body. Some animals are extremely tolerant of their health issues and tell me they're doing just fine. Others have begged me to tell their human to help them leave their body. You know your animal better than anyone, so it's always best that you go with your instincts and trust your intuition. If you're still confused about what to do, consider stepping outside of your feelings and think about what is best for your pet. What decision would prevent them from having to endure unnecessary pain? As a pet parent, try to act on their behalf and decide based on what is best for your pet. Consider your attitudes about a terminal illness or the dying process before your pet reaches that point. Think of death as a release, not an end, but a beginning to a new spiritual afterlife. Chapter 23. The Sting of Death. Goodbyes are not forever. Goodbyes are not the end. They simply mean I'll miss you until we meet again. Author unknown. Watching your pet during the moment of euthanasia can be a difficult sight to behold. I've had to do it many times, and it never gets any easier. The injection can sting as it enters their bloodstream, and your pet may cry out in discomfort. Though I haven't experienced that. Some veterinarians will give them a sedative to calm them, but that may slow down their circulatory system. It may take longer for the lethal drug to move through their system. Animals rarely mention the struggle you may see before they cross over. Most of the time, that struggle is their natural reflexes as the heart stops. They're usually so exhilarated to be out of their bodies that any signs of distress that you witness are not a part of their experience. If you feel guilty about having to euthanize your pet, here are a few things to consider. When you come from a place of love in your heart, when your intention is to do the right thing for your pet, they sense this and do not hold you responsible. Think about this scenario for just a moment. Every day of your pet's life, you set out to care for them and love them with all your heart. You fed them, medicated them, and probably changed your schedule around to accommodate their needs. Your pets know how much you love them, and they sense that you have only the best intentions when you are helping them leave their body. It would be an entirely different story if every day you set out to cause your animal nothing but pain and misery. If your intention was to do them harm, then the animals sense that. Since that is not the case, you can rest assured knowing that your good intentions come through loud and clear to your pet. Fortunately, the last few moments on this earth don't seem imperative to the animals. Rarely do they describe the brink of death as anything other than exhilarating. The best thing you can do to help your pet in their last moments is to stay calm and surround them with loving thoughts. Chapter 24, Cremation or Burial. How lucky I am to have something that makes saying goodbye so hard. Winnie the Pooh. What our pets want. What is the right thing to do with our animals' remains? Do we opt for cremation and put their urn on a shelf in our living room? Do we leave them at the veterinary office to be disposed of in a mass grave? What about backyard burials or spreading ashes in a favorite location? While this is a difficult subject to discuss, it is a reality we must face when we say goodbye to a dear and devoted friend. Most decisions are made under stressful situations or when our animals become gravely ill. I've heard a lot of interesting stories about what people do with their animals' remains, from taxidermy to burials and just about everything in between. The responses from the animals are always insightful and offer a new point of view. Truffles. Perry already made the decision of what to do with the remains of her beloved Yorkshire Terrier when the day came to say goodbye. As her aging dog, Truffles, was approaching the end of her physical life, the thought of being without her was overwhelming. She couldn't bear to think about going forward in her life without seeing her beloved companion, so she arranged to have Truffles preserved through cryopreservation. This freeze-drying method of preservation offers a unique alternative to cremation or burial. Truffles was excited about her lifelike image and said she felt very loved and very special when the process was complete. "That's me," she said with a big smile. The results were impressive, and it gave Perry the peace of mind to see her sweet girl sitting lifelike on her pink pillow. This was certainly the exception to what most people decide to do with their animals' remains, but here are a few more cases that come to mind. Cremation. When Bill and Andrea asked me to connect with their deceased cat, named Max, he showed me a wooden box with his name etched on it. We have that wooden box sitting right here next to the fireplace. They were thrilled that Max knew about it. It gives us a sense of peace knowing his remains are near us. It makes us feel like he's still here, still with us. Melissa scheduled a session to connect with her two deceased cats, Lily and Penny. When I opened up to Lily's energy, she kept showing me her silky black fur. "Talk about the fur," she said. I thought perhaps Lily was just a very silky kitty and wanted to show Melissa how vibrant she looked on the other side. When I checked in with Penny, she told me to say, "I'm right next to her heart," and kept showing me the shape of a Valentine's heart. Melissa explained how much those messages meant to her, because after each cat had passed away, she placed a portion of their ashes and fur in a heart-shaped locket, and she wore it every day. Both cats were happy that their mom thought about them every day as she wore the locket. They could feel the love Melissa had for them, and that's what made them happy. How pets feel about burial. Most animals do not feel connected to their remains after they cross over. They're usually very excited for their new afterlife journey to start. Very few pets mention what happened to their remains. Sandra was devastated when her husband left their deceased dog, Sammy, at the veterinary office to be disposed of in a mass grave while she was away on business. Ever since he died, she was worried that Sammy was lost in the afterlife and unable to find his way. Not so, reported Sammy. He was not the least bit concerned about what happened to his body. I'm no longer there, he said, as he proceeded to show me images of a backyard with a pool and covered patio. Tell her I'm right here, he said. Sandra was so relieved, as Sammy used to love to float on a raft in their backyard pool oasis. Do what makes you happy. The majority of pets I communicate with are not attached to their physical remains after death. They love when we think about them, so do whatever feels right to you. If your pet disappeared or you don't have their remains, conducting a ceremony, prayer, lighting a candle, or just remembering them with love will suffice. Your pet will feel honored and special when you remember them as they were in life, happy, healthy, and whole. Ultimately, they are okay with whatever makes you happy. Do animals have a soul? I've heard some theories that animals don't have souls, or that when they die, they go into a group consciousness and don't keep their individual character traits. I have not found that to be the case. Each of the animals I connect with maintain their unique personality. As an animal's soul progresses on the other side, they can choose to move into a collective consciousness. Merging with this type of soul group is rejuvenating for all, and yet they will still stay connected to the human they love. Chapter 25, The Journey Through Grief. Grief is not meant to be the soul's final destination, rather a resting place for the heart as we emerge onto the path of healing. Divinely communicated from the other side, Karen Anderson. Coping with the loss of a pet you love is one of life's most difficult challenges. Often the pain can feel overwhelming. You may experience all kinds of unexpected emotions, from denial, shock, or anger to guilt, disbelief, and profound sadness. The pain of grief can also disrupt your physical health, making it difficult to eat, sleep, or even think clearly. These are common reactions when suffering from a significant loss. Your pets love you so much. They want you to heal as soon as you can. They watch over you, diligently waiting by your side as you move through the stages of grief. As difficult as it is to suffer a loss, there are healthy ways to cope with the pain. But before we explore those steps, we need to take a closer look at what grief is and is not. Grief is defined as a normal and natural reaction to a significant loss of any kind. There are many different triggers, such as the loss of a job or a relationship, but the loss of a pet or loved one is one of the most profound losses we experience. What grief is not. Grief is not a disease or an illness. It is not a pathological condition or a personality disorder. Grief is not depression. Rather, depression may be brought about by our grief. It is not a sign of weakness or a reflection of poor character. It is not easy to recover from a significant loss. Common symptoms of grief. While a loss affects people in different ways, keep in mind that almost anything that you experience in the early stages of grief is normal. Shock, disbelief, sadness, anger, and guilt are some of the most common symptoms of grief. You may also have feelings of despair, emptiness, or intense loneliness. You may also cry a lot or feel emotionally unstable. Others may not be able to cry. Crying is a normal response to sadness, but it's not the only one. Those who don't cry may feel the pain just as deeply as those who do cry. They may simply have other ways of showing it. Physical symptoms. We often think of grief as a strictly emotional process, but grief often involves physical problems, including fatigue, nausea, lowered immunity, weight loss or weight gain, aches and pains, and insomnia. Broken heart syndrome. Experiencing extreme physical pain from a loss is a sign of deep love, severe stress, and may be a condition known as the broken heart syndrome. Women are more susceptible to this condition and should seek help at the first sign of physical pain. For more information about broken heart syndrome, go to www.heart.org. Chapter 26, After a Pet Dies. Ever has it been that love knows not its own depth until the hour of separation. Khalil Gibran. After the loss of a pet, many people struggle with what to say to the person suffering from a loss. It's not easy to talk to someone about losing their pet. We don't want to upset them or make them uncomfortable. So many times we say nothing. When we do say something, the words can come out all wrong. Here are a few things to avoid saying when someone has suffered a loss. Now they're in a better place. This implies they were in a horrible place with us. At least they aren't in pain anymore. This implies we allowed them to suffer. You can always adopt another pet. This means our pet was disposable. We don't want another pet. We want our pet. It is part of God's plan. This implies that God's plan is to cause us extreme pain. At least you have your other pets to love. I don't want my other pets. I want this pet. It is time to get on with your life. I'm not ready to move on. Now I feel even worse. I know how much you loved him, her. No, you don't know how much love I had for this pet. I know how you feel. You don't know how my pain feels. They lived a long, happy life with you. You should be happy about that. No, I'm actually very sad that they're gone. Losing a pet I love after so many years hurts. With as many pets as you have, you should be used to this by now. No, I'll never get used to the pain. Each loss brings about a new feeling of pain. Other statements to avoid. Avoid comparing your pain. For example, I just lost my cat and I know how you feel. No, you don't know how I feel. My feelings are my own. Avoid telling gruesome stories of other pets' deaths, such as, my sister just ran over her dog. It was horrible. Avoid trying to cheer them up. They may not be ready. Avoid asking if that person is okay. They are not okay. They are in the depths of despair. When someone you know has suffered the loss of a pet, try to be sensitive to their fragile emotions. Perhaps you can remember how you felt after you suffered a loss. Kindness goes a long way, as you will see in the next chapter. Chapter 27, How to Help After a Loss. Every positive thought propels you in the right direction. Author unknown. After a loss, many times we just want our loss to be acknowledged. We don't want to be fixed. We want our feelings to be heard. It helps us work through our feelings when we can share how deeply we love the pet we lost. Here are a few examples of what you can say when someone has suffered a loss. Acknowledge their loss. I'm so sorry to hear that, say their name, has passed away. I can't imagine how difficult this must be for you. I'm sorry you're going through this difficult time. I'm here for you. If I can do anything at all, just let me know. If you want to talk, I'm here. More ways to help. Check in with them in the days, weeks, and months after a loss. It only takes a second, but it means a lot to that person. Sometimes just being there with them, not saying a word, is helpful. Some people want to be alone. So text or reach out to let them know you care. Bring them flowers, send them a card, or make a donation in memory of their pet. Imagine you are topping off that person's heart with love. Quietly, in your mind, fill them up with positive thoughts. Every loving word or kind thought will be appreciated. And I just need to add that these things really seem to fit when a person has passed away as well. Chapter 28, How to Heal. Healing is an art. It takes time. It takes practice. It takes love. Maza Dota. We must each find our way through the shroud of grief into healing. The pain of grief can often cause you to withdraw from others and retreat into a world of pain. Some of us need this time to be alone, and we find peace in our solitude. We feel better by keeping to ourselves and working our way through our grief privately. Others may prefer the companionship of others and feel better when surrounded by family or friends. Do whatever feels right to you. If you seek the companionship of others, give yourself permission to focus on other topics other than your loss. Find support after a loss. Most of us will have a network of loved ones or coworkers who want to be supportive after a loss. It is the perfect time to lean on the people who care about you. Even if you take pride in being strong and self-sufficient, reach out to friends and family members or find a grief support group. Draw comfort from your faith or spiritual beliefs. If you follow a religious tradition, embrace the comfort that mourning rituals can provide. Spiritual activities that are meaningful to you, such as praying, meditating, or going to church, can offer solace. If you're questioning your faith in the wake of the loss, talk to a clergy member or others in your religious community for guidance. Support from others can help you heal. Join a support group or find a grief counselor who can help you work through your emotions. They can help you get on the path to healing. It is so important to take care of yourself and ask for assistance if you need it. Your departed pets love you so much, and they want you to heal as soon as you can. Suicide. In a few rare cases, I've had clients tell me they wanted to end their lives as they no longer wanted to live without their beloved pet. Fortunately, with my law enforcement background, I was trained to handle suicidal situations and encouraged each of them to seek counseling and recover from their grief. Remember, your pets love you more than anyone else in the world, and they want you to live out the rest of your life with joy and happiness in your heart. Someday, when it is our time to cross over, we will be reunited with our departed loved ones, and our bonds of love will be stronger than ever. Resources. For more information, go to www.helpguide.org. Chapter 29, Reincarnation. You were born and died many times. You are the soul who lived all of your lives. The Afterlife of Billy Fingers, a true story by Annie Kagan, which we have shared on our program in the past. Before I became a psychic, the topic of reincarnation intrigued me. I was fascinated by the idea. I was fairly confident that we do come back and experience another lifetime or two. Now, after 2 decades of validations, I am entirely convinced that animals reincarnate, sometimes more than once in a lifetime. I've witnessed dozens of cases with verified facts of animals reincarnating and returning to their beloved people. While they're all incredibly amazing stories, one story about reincarnation stands out among all the others. Captain. Frank contacted me when he lost his 5-year-old pit bull from a genetic illness. Frank was devastated by this unexpected loss and reached out to me in the hopes of reconnecting with his dog, Captain. At first, Frank was very skeptical and thought reincarnation was all a bunch of hogwash, as he later told me, but the sudden loss of Captain led him to investigate further. Frank said he Googled many psychics, but eventually he was drawn to my website. I believe Captain steered Frank in my direction. As soon as Frank asked Captain if he would return to him, I immediately started to receive vivid images and messages. Captain told me that Frank would find him on a Wednesday and that a human female would be involved. Captain also mentioned the letter I as having significance, and no, it looks more like a T, I'm sorry, and there was a reference to something big. Captain said there would be a very visible sign and kept mentioning the letter C. Armed with those messages, Frank set out with renewed hope that he would once again have Captain back in his life. About 3 months later, I received an email from Frank with a picture of a tiny pit bull puppy. Frank wanted to know if this was his little C, which is what he used to call Captain. As I opened the photo, I heard Captain say, "It is me!" And I could feel his excitement wash over me. I told Frank, "Little C is here." All the clues lined up. Frank said everything lined up when he was looking for his new puppy. He found him on a Wednesday. A woman named Tony had the puppies, and there was the letter C on the puppy's head. Frank named the puppy Cash to honor Captain. When I saw the photo of this tiny little puppy, I could not believe my eyes. On his head in plain sight was a letter C. Now that's a clear sign. The only message that didn't fit at the time was Captain's reference to something big. It would be several years later when that message would finally make sense. In a recent visit to the veterinary office, Cash weighed in at a whopping 133 pounds. Now that's big. As I was writing this chapter, I asked Frank what this experience was like for him. He said, "It was shocking. I couldn't believe it. Miracles do happen. I'm a believer now, all thanks to you, Karen. I can't take all the credit. It was Captain who made it all happen. It was a group effort, and it was the right time for both of them to reunite. This case was fascinating, especially with the letter C on the puppy's head. Reuniting Frank and Captain was a moment I will never forget." No rule books about reincarnation. There are many different beliefs and viewpoints about reincarnation. Some are similar to my experiences with the animals, and other perspectives are way out in the cosmos. I can only speak from my personal experiences and share what I've learned over the years and from the animals themselves. First of all, there is no rule book with checklists and requirements on whether or not your pet will reincarnate. At least I've yet to find such a book. However, there is a universal law that governs each animal's soul and their future incarnations. Each embodiment has a unique and meaningful purpose, and an animal's soul may reincarnate once, multiple times, or never. This universal law is often referred to as a soul contract, Akashic record or life book. These contracts are not written in stone. Rather, they serve as a guide or a navigational tool, and as situations shift, so can the agreements. I have learned that we are each a part of a soul group consisting of animals, humans, and spirit guides. Within our soul group, we have an understanding with the other souls to assist each other to learn and grow while we are in physical form. That understanding or agreement includes future incarnations. Before each of our physical lives on Earth, we select the lessons we will learn and the other people and animals who will provide us with the optimum opportunity for accomplishing those lessons. Lessons may be about learning patience or tolerance if you have an especially challenging pet. Other lessons include compassion, forgiveness, and courage. Each pet brings us a new lesson, and usually the most challenging pet provides us with our greatest life lesson. Our agreements with our pets can shift if situations change. For instance, if you and your pet, such as a horse, have an agreement to share another lifetime together, then when the right situation presents itself, the pet's soul can reincarnate. However, if the situation changes, such as if you move from a farm to an apartment, your agreement with your horse will shift. Since you can't have a horse in an apartment, the horse can choose to return as a smaller pet, such as a bird, cat, or small dog. Do all animals reincarnate? In my experience, I have found that not all animals reincarnate. Some animals tell me they have completed their mission with us and there's no need for them to return. Other times, I hear that the animals are excited and ready to return when the time is right. Well, we come now to the end of our program. As always, I wish you a beautiful, joyous, and peaceful new week, and I look forward to being with you next time on our Philosopher Program.